Welcome to Red Ice Creations Radio. This is Henrik Palmgren. I am the editor of redicecreations.com and I am your host. Thank you for tuning in to this Thursday show. We are just about in the middle of April and we're moving towards summer finally, at least up here in the Western Hemisphere. If you are new to this program, you might want to know that we have a new show available through our website every Thursday and Sunday. We archive all of our shows in case you want to backtrack. And we certainly got a number of great shows with our archive, with our guest who's with us here today, our monthly regular, Michael Tesserion, who joins us every third Thursday of every month. And today we are going to begin to talk about the origins of Lucifer, the connections to light and atonism, and much, much more. And before we bring Michael on, just let me mention his website, michaeltesserion.com, where you can find all his links to his blog, his taroscopes.com website, and originsandoracles.com for the excellent and extensive DVD series, and much, much more. For all you guys who are interested in finding out more about and from Michael, highly recommended stuff. And to get things going today, I thought we could begin to read a paragraph from the somewhat famous letter, I guess, from Albert Pike to Mazzini, and we have talked about this before. But this material comes up again and again and is always, you know, interesting and important to address. There's much information kind of hinged on this and surrounding it. So let me begin to read this paragraph here first. "We shall unleash the nihilists and atheists, and we shall provoke a formidable social cataclysm, which in all its horror will show clearly to the nations the effort of absolute atheism, origins of savagery, and of the most bloody turmoil. Then, everywhere, the citizens obliged to defend themselves against the world minority of revolutionaries will exterminate those destroyers of civilization, and the multitude, disillusioned with Christianity, anxious for an ideal, will receive the true light through the universal manifestations of the pure doctrine of Lucifer." That's the famous quote there in the letter from Albert Pike to Mazzini, and this is written in 1871. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the program. What do you think about that quote there?
Thank you for reading it. It's a good way to open the show on this origins of Lucifer question, because, again, in the very last sentence, within a few words of each other, he's talking about that light is connected to Lucifer, you know. So wherever you find the term Lucifer, you're finding the term light. And it's very important to realize that Pike is a man who, like so many people who are standing on the, you know, the threshold between the seen and the unseen, and the known and the unknown, and the apparent and the illusionary, this man understood that, you know, the Bible and so many documents of religion, they have several levels of meaning. He openly said himself many times, you see, that only initiated people could really understand or crack the code of the Bible. You know, and I just want to emphasize that a lot, that people are reading these documents every day, they're hearing these terms, and, you know, these terms have double or triple meanings. It's not what we're told in Sunday school. It's not necessarily, you know, what we are originally led to believe. But again, just the very idea that, why is there a connection? People in their mind, they associate Lucifer or, you know, with Satan, which may or may not be true. I mean, we can explore that in today's show. But,
sure,
you know, if you're talking about the negative power, then what on earth is, why would even somebody who's a worshiper of Lucifer be talking about light? It seems incongruous that, you know, the so-called Lord of Darkness is connected so much with light. So right there, we've got already a very interesting contradiction, a very interesting problem.
Absolutely.
To look into, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Let me read a second paragraph here to get more ideas swirling, so to speak. And this is from Irish Origins of Civilization, the volume 2. This is the new and upcoming book from Michael. And this is also in his on his taroscopes.com website, the excellent article series, the huge article series called Akhenaten, the Cult of Aton, and the Dark Side of the Sun. This is what it says. "Those writers and investigators who have accused Adam Weishaupt, Albert Pike, Giuseppe Mazzini, Adriano Lemmi, and other Illuminati grandmasters of being Luciferians, who do well to acknowledge, would do well to acknowledge the ancient roots of this ideology, so beloved of the cultists they expose. The origin of Luciferianism is Atonism, and the master masons of the world would much prefer it if this fact was never openly revealed. They prefer people to connect their god Lucifer with the horned devils and tempting demons of Christian lore. That kind of distracting error serves to obscure the complexion and nature of their bizarre doctrine. The initiated insiders is the one to whom Lucifer's true name is revealed. He is the one to be exalted by knowledge. After his blindfold is removed before the altar, it is he who will be illumined and enlightened by the radiance of Lucifer, or more correctly, of Aton. Interesting stuff.
Yeah, this is a, you know, it sort of presents in a nutshell the basic idea. And I mean, I'm sure that comes as a shock to even Masons when they finally find out what's going on. For some, it may be a pleasant shock.
Mm.
For some, they may have already guessed it. And for others, it could be a complete another shock to find out that, wait a minute, you're talking about Egyptian pharaohs here. You're talking about the Christ before the Christ. You know, you're talking about a very antique, ancient tradition.
Mm.
You know, so that when we're looking back and trying to trace the origins of modern Freemasonry in the whole of the secret society networks, you know, people have looked like back to Babylon, you know, into the cult of Saramis and whatnot.
Sure.
And you go back to, people have even traced this through Mithras, you know, through the cult of Mithras.
Yeah.
The cult of Dionysus, you know, Zoroastrianism, you name it.
Mm.
And, you know, my work just goes, look, can we not understand that this, you know, all of those themselves go back to this perverted form of solar worship?
Because
there's nothing wrong with the sun, there's nothing wrong with light, there's nothing wrong with solar worship.
Yeah.
Christianity is a version of solar theocracy.
Sure.
A theology, but it's a specific kind. And so when we're talking about Luciferianism, you know, this is one area that needs to be looked into.
Mm, yeah.
But, you know, again, in that statement, you know, again, you hear the whole concept about that there is one tradition for the outsider, and then there's one tradition from the insider. The people within have a different understanding and interpretation. So my work is very much about bringing that forward to the ordinary public so that we get a little bit of an understanding of the differences in the way that these notions of light are understood. It's not the way light is not understood by secret society members, members of the Illuminati, members of the Temple of Saul, Amon Saul, right? The Knights of the Temple of Saul. They have a completely different understanding of what light is than the average Christian, you see, or the average Muslim, or the average Jew, you know?
Yeah.
And again, I mean, people need to look at the Bible and realize that there's so many different stories there, you know. We got contradictions. My work focuses a lot on the actual contradictions that are in the Bible. I mean, for instance, give you, you know, like two examples. You know, they say that God got so unhappy with the primal parents that he basically comes down to destroy his creation.
Hmm.
First of all, the creation was 6 days in creation. It was a great creation, and then God is so unhappy with the actions, you know, of Adam and Eve because they were sinners.
Mm.
That he basically says, I'm going to, you know, destroy the creation. Well, the contradiction is, why did he not just destroy Satan, who caused all the problems in the first place?
Mm. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, Adam and Eve sinned, yeah, but they sinned because they were tempted by Satan. Wouldn't it have been better if God had just dealt with Satan and left everything else alone?
Mm. Yeah.
But no, he destroys the entire creation, all animals, all life on the earth, you know, saves only Noah. Completely leaves Satan alone and doesn't even bother with him at all.
Huh.
I mean, that's, you know, completely insane. What's with that?
Indeed.
Well, again, a non-initiated person who doesn't know about the pre-Adamite peoples, who just buys into what the Bible is saying and takes that for history, well, yeah, it's a contradiction. They're not going to understand it. Another one is, you know, that man is said to be made in God's image. Adam and Eve are meant to be made in God's image, but then, of course, that's contradictory because they're not made immortal. God, of course, doesn't die. He's immortal, but Adam and Eve are not immortal.
Mm.
They have a, you know, finite life, and they're not around on the earth today. They died.
Hmm.
So right there, you have another contradiction in the Bible.
Yeah.
You know, and there's hundreds of these just within the book of Genesis.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So again, people can either, you know, be cynical and throw the book across the room and say, okay, I'm done with that. I'm an atheist. And I do not agree that that is a intelligent action, you know, which is you find in the world a lot today.
Yeah,
people
sure.
have to realize, no, it's not because the Bible is written by idiots. It's because it's written, yeah. you know, in code. There's a whole mythological, labyrinthine, you know, symbolic story going on there, and
yeah.
it's so much more interesting than just throwing the book in the trash and saying, I give up
yeah.
with all of this, and then pursue your damn materialistic lifestyle or whatever.
Sure.
It's important to learn about it and find out what's all that mean.
Sure. And I mean, we have been pushing, I guess, that kind of idea, at least on this show a little bit, that the idea of the idea that the Bible actually works also as a blueprint for you know current times and all of this, because again, I mean, the people can make of that what they will, but the Bible is prominently featured on the altar in Masonic lodges and all of that too. So I mean, there are connected there.
There's even a thing called a Masonic Bible.
Yeah, sure, exactly, sure.
All Masons
yeah.
are given one,
yeah.
and that Bible is meant to be returned at the Mason's death back to the lodge.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't have to do that, but you know, because the wife of a dead Mason can keep that book, you know.
Okay, yeah.
But normally it's meant to be, you know, sent back to the lodge at the time of the death. And you can pick up these Masonic Bibles occasionally at certain, you know, antique bookstores or maybe, you know, antiquarian bookstores. You can actually go and you look at it, and it's not quite the same as the normal Bible. And they're very illustrated. They've got beautiful pictures inside it of the Temple of Solomon. You know, certain verses are much more important to Masons.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
when you really realize, you know, if people are familiar with my work, they'll know that I'm echoing exactly the same thing as what Ralph Ellis and what Ahmed Osman and Mustafa Gadala have been saying, you know, in the last 10, 12 years, or a little bit more, maybe 16 years or so, that look, you know, the Bible is really the record of the pharaohs. It's really a book of the pharaohs.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and since the pharaohs, I mean, you only have to look at pictures of the pharaohs to see them wearing the Masonic apron.
Sure.
The Masonic aprons all come from the symbol. You know, you can see those the pharaohs wearing exactly the same thing. The triangular shaped aprons, not to mention all the other regalia. Well, you know, the Masonic lodges, the Freemasonic lodges are originated, or at least the form that we know now originates in the Egypt.
Sure.
And the whole concept of Masons believing in the Temple of Solomon goes back to the Temple of Jerusalem,
yeah.
which of course was created by the Israelites, who people like Ralph Ellis and Ahmed Osman have shown the Israelites are nothing more than a dynasty of Egyptian pharaohs.
Exactly, yeah.
So, you know, one thing connects to the other. We gotta start deconstructing this idea that we have about the Israelites and the Zionists and stop thinking them as Jews that are religious converts today. And particularly Jews need to worry about this because, you know, something deadly is hiding under the face of Judaism, just like something deadly is hiding under the face of Christianity.
Yeah.
And it's time that the Jews and Christians woke up to this atomism that is happening in their midst and not associate with it in any way.
Yeah. You know, I'm just thinking about this idea, and don't know if you want to comment about it, but it is also regarding, you know, the idea of seeking the light, you know, we as persons, or, you know, those who are spiritual seekers. And I don't know if this is connected with, in some sense, the word bliss, and of course the obvious, you know, phrase connected with bliss is, you know, ignorance is bliss, and so forth. Do you want to pick up on this at all? Do you find there is a connection here in some way?
Well, yeah. I mean, why would the Illuminati, who obviously can you know, consider themselves the elites? So we got words like pupil, you know, a youngster. These terms, you know, a pupil, a school pupil. A pupil is because it was representing the sun, which is the light of day.
Yeah.
You know, people were given stars for matriculation, you know, for doing well. The elites, the elders, you know, all of these terms go back to meanings of light.
Yeah.
The Illuminati, what would they possibly be using a term like that for when they consider themselves illustrious ones or alumni?
Yeah.
So the whole tie-in of knowledge, the way I look at it is there's nothing wrong with seeking knowledge. It's when you're manipulated to believe that there's a secret knowledge.
Yeah.
We have it, you don't.
Sure.
But if you join us and jump through all these hoops and, you know, do all these rituals and rites and basically leave your humanity and your morality behind, you know, you will inherit some secret knowledge that only the adepts knew.
Sure. Yeah.
But wait a minute. You know, Adam was created in the image of God. man is already an adept. Man is already made perfect. What's all this stuff about secret knowledge that he needs to have?
Yeah.
Nature is his greatest teacher. So first of all, you're telling us that we can't travel across borders. We're not free to go anywhere on this planet, even though we're born as souls, incarnated on the planet, which is our greatest teacher. But we are not able to go and visit free of charge all our brothers and sisters in all parts of the world. We got to have licenses and passports and money and expensive plane tickets and all sorts of malarkey tied down to jobs. So we can't even move freely around the world. You're going to deny us the number one form of education on this earth.
Yeah.
But you're going to then tell us that, you've got secret knowledge on the other side for us.
Hmm.
I mean, what could be more contradictory than that?
Yeah, exactly.
The hell with all the rites and rituals and all of that. You know, let me just be a person who can travel all throughout the world. That's all the learning I would need.
Hmm.
That's all the learning anybody would need.
I saw a documentary called Freemasons on Trial recently, and allegedly, at least, some film crew was allowed into this lodge where they did a few of their, beginning rituals, so to speak, on when they opened the lodge and all this stuff. And I mean, we had this bunch of, old guys sitting in there and one thing that kind of, stood out to me at least was that it was so soulless. It was so it was such a ritual that it was like bad acting theater basically, and it's all seemed so silly to me. I mean, they are in there having their secrets or whatever. I mean, and I don't care what they do in that sense, but it all seemed so so silly to me, and it felt like all of this and these systems now are actually, hopefully coming down in that sense, because people are also tired of the fact that, there are so many secrets, and if you start up an organization that is involved with, hiding stuff or whatever, actually are going to be brought into, the light, as it were. What do you think about that?
I agree. Even if there's knowledge there or not, really, at the end of the day, it doesn't even matter whether there is secret knowledge or there isn't secret knowledge.
Yeah.
But the idea that one group of men tell another group of men, you are nothing and you got to be, we are in charge now of your destiny.
Mm.
You see, I take exemption to that. The libraries have got Plato, Aristotle, Schopenhauer, Nietzsche. All you got to do is go and pick up a book. You don't need any of these, people in doing what they're doing. So what I'm looking at is that there is secret knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
There is secret knowledge. There is a journey to go on.
Mm-hmm.
But they are not the keepers of it. They're manipulating your desire for mystery, for higher knowledge, you see?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that there isn't something greater knowledge that you should be attaining.
Mm-hmm.
Of course all men need to attain greater knowledge and greater use of their reason. But these societies, what's really Luciferian about it in many ways is the hierarchy concept, where they're promising you something because they're playing upon a natural need that you and I have, for to learn more.
And
therefore it's a kind of a seduction.
Mm.
And through this seduction, you don't know until the end. The beauty of it is it's like a labyrinth. You don't know until you've gone around the next corner what's waiting for you.
Mm.
So this is a perfect manipulative way. If knowledge was provided, the Vatican libraries were open to everybody, and people say, oh, there's no initiations, it's your own will.
Mm.
You go and read as you feel like, or you go and study as you... Then there'd be no control mechanism. So we got two things running here parallel. We've got man's quest for greater knowledge, which I believe, you can access on your own by reading so many books and, going and studying yourself and traveling.
Mm.
And then you've got the manipulation of man's desire for knowledge.
Mm, yeah.
So that there can be a hierarchy of control, to control his body, to control his thinking. And as you say, these rituals, actually some of the rituals in themselves are quite beautiful. But if the men doing them are soulless creatures who have lost their own spontaneity, who have no true sense of humanity, and in fact you need to join some stupid occult order in order to feel virtuous, what is that all about?
Yeah.
A man is either virtuous or he's not virtuous. It's not going to be joining some club is going to make him virtuous.
Hmm. Yeah.
So we've got a lot of manipulation going on here. And this is the thing. It's not that there is no great secrets. There are. There's so many, many revelations that people can have.
Mm-hmm.
But you see, we have enough books in circulation in the world from some of the greatest writers.
Mm-hmm.
We've got symphonies, we've got art galleries. What greater mystery is it than to go and study the work of, M.C. Escher, what greater enlightenment can you imagine of studying the work of, you know, Bruegel?
Hmm.
You know, Peter Bruegel the Elder. I look at the artwork of Peter Bruegel the Elder, and I'm in heaven.
Hmm.
You know, I'm being enlightened. I mean, just by studying that man's art.
Hmm. Hmm.
You know, what do I need from secret societies?
Yeah, sure.
You know, so there's the whole thing is that you are your own chapel, you are your own temple. People need to get into that and stop looking for it outside.
Mm, yeah, sure. I totally agree. How about the idea, you know, that when these lodges and so forth first was created, it was because, you know, they and their knowledge in that sense were actually, you know, they were being hunted down, so to speak, and actually fleeing from all of this. And I guess that we now then are in this, you know, turmoil, you know, this period where when we actually can, again, you know, freely, at least to some sense degree, talk about information and so forth and have access to information. But when these societies and so forth was created, you weren't able to, you know, circulate what kind of information you wanted. What do you
think
about? Well,
of course, that's in their history. They do say that. I don't necessarily believe that.
Mm.
Because the very people that they say in their own history that, you know, were hunting them, they created. I mean,
yeah.
You gotta understand that. And remember, don't forget that these people do have factionalisms within their own.
Exactly.
Setup.
Sure, sure.
You know what I mean? I mean, they got loves and they got hates. And it's very easy for those to be manipulated in history to say, okay, we were hard done by.
Mm.
You know, really who's been hard done by is the human race. The human race has been plagued by these secret societies, not the other way around.
Mm. Yeah.
And even though they've had skirmishes amongst themselves, and they've had breaches, and they've had, you know, changes of status quo and whatnot, you know, I wouldn't worry about it. These people are very, very powerful. The kind of atomism that I talk about that I believe is true Luciferianism, of which Christianity is but a part, is but a tentacle, you know, they're the ones who are going around, you know, causing all sorts of trouble.
Mm.
You know, they've been causing all sorts of trouble in the world. It's not so much that they've been hunted. They're quite the contrary. They're very, very powerful. These are people who are, you know, ruling the show from the greatest seats of power in the world. Now, at certain, they have grudges. They keep long, long grudges. So there's no doubt about it that they often take out certain people that are members of their own societies because of certain breaches or certain changes of allegiance.
Yeah,
we all know the kings, you know, and these people are megalomaniacs. So they're very easy to rub up the wrong way.
Hmm.
And they don't tolerate, you see, anyone, you know, breaching any of their codes.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Kennedy, the Kennedy family, they can be part of the superstructure, but they can also be disciplined and murdered.
Sure, yeah, exactly.
When the case, you know, comes to... I mean, Lady Diana Spencer, I believe that was an assassination. Obviously, she's high-ranking. Her family is a very high-ranking, you know, within these orders, going all the way back to Queen Elizabeth I, but yet they saw fit to take out that individual because you may be... You know, they have rules. They have very strict rules within their own order about conduct and what you can and cannot do.
Sure.
And they have to send very strong messages to other members, you see.
Yeah.
This is like any secret society. I mean, if it's good enough for the mafia to go and kill their own, you know, bosses when it suits them.
Sure.
You know, no boss in the mafia ever felt that secure.
Yeah.
The only way they felt secure is by going killing everybody else. Well,
yeah.
It's, you know, their enemies. So it's exactly the same way further up the spectrum.
Sure.
It's only the people at the very, very top. There's the very, very senior ones who are hidden.
Mm.
Why they're called hidden is because even members within their own order don't know who they are.
Yeah.
They're secure, yeah.
Hmm.
You know, it's like the European Union right now.
Mm-hmm.
European Union, behind the Union, the people officiating out of Belgium, is a very secret group.
Sure.
I mean, this is known in politics, my God. We're not even talking secret societies here.
Yeah.
Ordinary politicians know that the MEPs in Europe are being guided and controlled by a hidden elect of non-elected, right, people in the steering committee of the European Union.
Mm, yeah.
And this is very much the same thing that's happening in America, where the people in the Federal Reserve,
sure,
and then people in higher elements, you know, the Black Pope and all of this. So even within a political spectrum, you have very, very elusive people who are untouchable.
Sure, and all the advisors and the, you know, these kind of people sit up there and you know, no matter who, you know, the politician on the front, you know, they change back and forth every few years, but the advisors, you know, in the back, they remain the same, basically, so.
And they can be taken out if they should, you know, go over to the other side, or they should try to feather their own nests too much, or try to get too big for their boots.
Sure.
You know, people even watched that fantastic comedy that was made in England called Yes, Prime Minister.
No, haven't seen it.
You remember that show, Yes, Minister, and then it became Yes, Prime Minister?
Okay, I haven't seen
it. It's a comedy, a British comedy. People just need to, you know, get that online and buy some, just watch those DVDs, and they'll tell you the whole story of what I'm talking about. And we're just talking politics, pretty much straight politics.
Yeah, sure.
You know, so these people in these secret societies are basically paranoid. They cannot afford the true, they don't mind if people know about their identity. But they do mind if the secrets from within the lodge, you see, the true secrets, ever get told out of by members of their own order, you know?
Sure, sure.
Because people, you know, like we're talking on this show, they don't want to have it be known that the Jehovah, the Yahweh of the Bible, is exactly the same personality that they're talking about when they mention Lucifer. People are not meant to know that. They don't mind if you think Lucifer is some horned devil, and that people like Albert Pike are actually bowing down to some sort of horned devil, you know, who lives in hell, they don't mind giving you that cartoon. But the last thing they want you to know is that people like Albert Pike are worshipping the same Jehovah, Yahweh, that Christians are worshipping. There's no difference. Those secrets are not meant to come out. They want you to believe that there's some sort of dark, satanic, you know, order out there who's worshipping some sort of demonic entity. Like you see in some Dungeons and Dragons movie, you know, climbing out of the swamp.
Sure.
Well, but it's not like that. There's no difference whatsoever between Aton, because Aton is Adonai, which is the secret name of Jehovah.
Yeah, indeed.
Jehovah's number is 10, number 10, because Yahweh, the first letter in Hebrew, is Yod, the very, very sacred and very first letter of the name of God in Hebrew. The four letters of the name of God is Yod, He, Vav, He, and the first letter, Yod, is always one, the phallic one, or number 10. Number 10.
Ten
and the Roman numeral for number 10 is a cross, right?
Six. Sure, absolutely.
Like an Andrew's cross, which you see on flags, you see on products. And, you know, British government coming from number 10.
Sure, 10 Downing Street, yeah.
That's right. Athens, Aten, Aton, we're talking Aton.
Yeah.
Aton, Aten, it just means the number 10. So they want to find out where the Atenists are. You know, people sending me emails, hey man, you're crazy. We don't see any Akhenaten, we don't see any Aten. Oh, you don't, huh? You only see 10 Downing Street, which is the number 10 comes from Aton. Go and look at the window, the rose window above number 10 Downing Street. By the way, that happens to be, the rose window is always the shape of the rising sun, the panes are the rising sun. If you look at the panes, and there's eight of them, because eight is also the number of the sun.
You see,
which is the eighth card of the tarot, is the card of the sun. In the very central pane, you see a little arrow. There's a little arrow there.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, you got people can come to the website and check it out. They got eight panes, and the little tiny pane in the middle, so very, very small, is a Martian arrow, an arrow of the symbol of the sign of Aries, which is ruled by the sun. The sun is exalted, what they call of great power, in astrological terms, in the sign of Aries. And this is what Akhenaten was all about. If anyone wants to understand anything, even the most basic stuff that motivated Akhenaten, this is a physical man that lived, you know, 1400 years B.C.
Yeah.
He's considered by so many scholars in the world to be the Christ before the Christ, the first monotheist, all the stuff that they say. If you want to understand the brain or the mind of this man, Akhenaten, the pharaoh, you've got to understand that he was completely preoccupied by an astrological change in the heavens that was taking place. And the scholar Ralph Ellis goes into this. He talks about this change. In the sky, during the time of Akhenaten, the sun was moving its house. It was moving from the sign of Taurus into the sign of Aries. The sun goes backwards through the zodiac, what they call precessional movement. But people don't need to, you know, if they're not familiar with astrology, they don't need to memorize all this. It just means that just like the sun moves through the year in a particular orbit, well, there's a bigger year. It's called the Platonic year or the Great Year, in which the sun moves backwards slowly through all the houses of the zodiac. And during the time of Akhenaten, their sun god, I mean, these people worship light. They worship the sun. their God was moving his house. And to the people in those days, nothing could be more important. To the priests of the temples of Heliopolis, you see in Amarna and Giza,
sure,
this was extremely important. I mean, you pulled out the best china and the silver, you know. I mean, this was a big deal.
Yeah.
This was a real big deal, this movement. And then, of course, what Akhenaten found out is that most of Egypt couldn't care less. The Amunist priests, who maybe had a slightly different kind of astrology or whatever, we don't want to waste time talking about it, but the rest of Egypt wasn't as preoccupied as he was, and they kept on staying with the old system. They said, no, the sun is still in Taurus, and even if it's making a move, that's fine, but we still continue with the symbolism, and we continue with the rites of the bull, the golden calf, the sacred calf, the sacred animal of Amun. Akhenaten completely divorced himself then from most of Egypt by saying that the sun is moving into Aries. So when we're understanding about the sun, when we're understanding about light, when we're understanding about Luciferianism, it's connected astrologically to the sign of Aries. And this opens a whole ball of wax of the sacred symbolism of the connecting to Aries, which I go into in one of the DVDs on the DVD in this series that I have. I do a DVD on subversive use of sacred symbolism.
Yeah.
And if people revisit that particular DVD with it, what we're saying now in mind about the Aryan symbols, they're going to start seeing that Aryan symbolism in a different way, because Saturnian symbolism is used a lot. You know, Venusian symbolism is used a lot. But in connection to Atenism, Henrik, it's very much an Aries, the sign of Aries and the sign of Leo. Fire signs are very, very important to bear in mind. And Akhenaten himself was preoccupied by this. This move into the sign of Aries. And the sign of Aries, as any astrologer knows, is ruled by the planet Mars. And you see the little arrow of Mars above the door at 10 Downing Street. It's all Atenistic symbolism.
Fascinating. That's amazing. Yeah, because I've been wondering about that. And of course, to me, you know, in that sense, the 10 also connect with, you know, the 1 and the 0 and all of this stuff going into the, you know, digital age and all of this. But that is definitely a fascinating story. And by the way, I just wanted to sneak this in here before we carry on here. Do you think that the, I guess, universe, as it were, kind of favors people in a sense, I guess, spiritually or whatever you want to choose the term there, but favors people who kind of are in tune with these changes, so to speak?
Yeah, because you see, most communication of a non-linear nature takes place by way of symbolism. And so people who are symbol literate, they don't have to be good people. In fact, the problem why I work in the field that I do is because I'm sick and tired of the fact that the people who are more symbolically literate are the, what I would consider the negative people of the earth. You know, you've got to do something about that. You got the worst people in the world, the most virtuous and the most immoral and the most anti-human people, but they're the big brains. Well, you know, that's really stacking the cards against the human race. That has got to change. You know, I don't have too much faith in the human race, but I'll still work, you know, to do what I can, because that dynamic has just got to change. You can't have occult knowledge in the hands of immoral people. Now, yesterday, you know, in ages gone past, you didn't have occult knowledge in the hands of evil people, because you had a shamanic class of people who would take care of that, who would make sure that, you see, that you didn't matriculate. You, a person who had immoral traits would have long ago been taken care of. We're walking loose. We have a situation in society where there's no filters. There's all the shamans are dead and gone, all the druids, all the white, the, you know, the priests of light are gone. So of course there's nothing barring scheming and anti-human, you know, people from getting access to occult knowledge. So, you know, my work is trying to say, look, people of the world, you know, you got to change this dynamic. Start waking up. It's a very interesting study. And, you know, there's so much to learn and so much to get inspired by. And also realize at the same time that, you know, you got a fight on your hands here, because the people who are using symbolism, the people who are tuning in to what is these archives of knowledge, they don't mean you well. And you're going to have to, you know, you're going to have to sort of find out and use the tools of occult knowledge, you know, in order to know your enemy and to do something about it.
Yeah, indeed. You know, I just wanted to also ask you in regards to, I guess we could call it channeling, or the search for light, or you know, the fact that Akhenaten might have been, you know, in some sense connected with this. But this is a topic that has been fascinating to me in the last few months here, and this is about the what is known as the Nine, or the Ennead, which of course is the Egyptian, you know, the nine forces of the world and all this. Do you go into this at all in regards to that?
Yes, in fact, that connects to the Kabbalah. You see, that this is one of the Kabbalistic system is also based on nine or ten, you know, spheres of light, and this connects very much to the idea of Lucifer. Even Jesus is meant to have said in the Bible that he saw Lucifer falling from heaven as a lightning flash.
And that's
a big giveaway, because the lightning flash is always known in Kabbalah from the earliest times, the descent of light through ten regions was known as the lightning flash. And it's a very, very, very fascinating story about why that should be. And each of those zones through which the light falls in the Kabbalistic system was given over to a different god. And of course, in the Egyptian scheme, they had the all-purveying Atum, you see, or Ta, depending on what school you came from, you know. And so they had an Ennead, or they had a Triad, you know. That each particular, I think, in Heliopolis, there was the Ennead, the famous Ennead of nine gods.
Sure, yeah.
So, in fact, the Bible, the books of Genesis, are all based on the mystery school traditions of Heliopolis and Hermopolis. Yeah, exactly as they're taught, you know, with Ta, and then Atum, and then Osiris, you see, and all of the different gods. It's a whole study in itself there.
Sure,
but
sure.
In Luciferianism, it's very important that this transition of light from the top to the bottom, from the first to the tenth. Again, there we have 1-0 again.
Exactly, yeah.
Or we have 0-1-0, whatever way you want to look at it.
Yeah.
Actually, it's 0-1 to 1-0 is 1 to 10. Because the 1 comes out of the nothing. The 1 is really properly said 0-1. And 10 is 1-0. So it's 1 takes birth from the nothing, or the 0, or the what they call the Pleroma. And then 1 goes back to the Pleroma at the end of the cycle. And of course, this would have been... in fact, that's why a 9 looks like a 9. A 9 is a 1 that's curving or bending around, trying to become a circle again. And in fact, the word 9 in German is like very close to the word for nothing. 9, meaning no.
Oh, I see what you mean, yeah.
See, like neuter, to say no, to have nothing again. So 9 or 10 is like going back full circle. It's a very, very powerful concept. Of course, as you said, you know, it just happens to be bizarre that the binary system, you know, has helped to involve, you know, create the computer intelligence.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
There might be something to that, you know. And of course, look at all the logos that involve Luciferian light.
Yeah, indeed.
When it comes to computer companies and all of that.
Yeah.
You know, it's amazing. Even the Windows logo, you know, is striking just how many connections there is Kabbalistically and so forth and so on to the whole concept of light.
Sure, sure. Also, I just wanted to throw this in here. I don't know if you agree on this or not, but I've heard at least that the 11 is a number of destruction, and this brings me up to, you know, I think it's known as the dot, or the invisible spot in the Kabbalah, which actually connects with a klipoth. And I don't know if do you know if this is the zero that the one comes out of in that sense?
Well, the number 11 for me in Kabbalah does not relate to, you're talking about the Dejuat, or the Juat, which is the underworld?
Yeah, I think it's known as the Doth, or also, I don't know if...
Oh, yeah, I see what you mean. Well, that's right, then I do agree. Doth, yeah, D-A-A-T-H.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, that's the 11th hidden Sephiroth, so you're absolutely right. The 11 is not a number necessarily of negativity. 11 is a number that talks about... it's really a number of choice.
Okay.
And decision. Yeah, it's a very complex. It's a master vibration. There's a lot you can talk about the 11. It's really about. It's almost like the number 11 is the signature of people who have the ability to go completely towards the good and completely towards the bad.
Okay. Yeah, because this obviously is interesting in regards to that. This, you know, event on 01, the 2001, of course, was 9/11. You know, the World Trade Center disaster. So some numerology there, right there. So
Well, see, the 11 in the tarot is connected to justice. It's the card known as justice.
Mm.
And that is always about judgment. You know, a path of being and of course that card goes right back to the Egyptian goddess Maat.
Yeah.
So 11 represents homeostasis or perfect balance or and truth and virtue or the lack of it. It's a, you know, the great scales that you see in the Egyptian system where the, you know, the soul is judged with the great scales. That is very much connected to the symbol of Maat, which is the 11th card in the tarot. So 11 is the number of justice and about whether a person is living a virtuous life and is a person of justice, you see, or they're just a performer of a bunch of good deeds. There's a difference, you know. A lot of people can perform good deeds, but very few people are actually virtuous. There's a difference. You know, so there's a whole question there, yeah.
How about the, you know, the Eye of Ra or the Eye of Horus? Because, again, top on the of the pyramid, the Egyptian connection, all of this. Do you think that the eye on top of the pyramid is the Eye of Horus?
No. It's the Eye of Aton.
It is, yeah.
And his disciples. It's the Eye of Akhenaten. It's the Eye of Tutankhamun. It's the Eye of Eye. In fact, Ralph Ellis has a brilliant, you know, sort of a story to tell about one of the Egyptian pharaohs that came after Akhenaten. When Akhenaten was booted out of Egypt, for a short time, another major Atenist ruled, you know, for a very short time, for 4 years. He was actually, I think, the uncle of Akhenaten, and his name was Eye, like your eye. So he, Ralph Ellis claims that the eye at the top of, you know, the pyramid, I don't know if he addresses the eye itself at the top of the pyramid, but when I read it, I immediately thought that that eye is literally the Eye of Eye. Because the guy's name was Pharaoh Eye, you know?
Yeah.
It's also pronounced Aya, A-Y-A.
Okay.
But that word meant the physical organ of sight. So that eye at the top of the pyramid is absolutely not to do with Ra. It is not to do with Horus. It is not to do with Osiris. It's very specific. We have too many people, you know, in the West who know very little about Egyptian mythology, but then they see the pyramid and they go, okay, you know, they need to be more specific. So I think it's good that people have realized it's an Egyptian symbol, but they need to go a little bit further and realize that, wait a minute, Egypt was 32 dynasties long. You know, it lasted about 3,000 years or more. You got to be specific about what kind of, you know, symbolism you're talking about.
Yeah, sure.
That is a very late symbol. That came out of the 18th dynasty. It's literally, you know, the eye of Akhenaten and his cronies who were trying to build a new world order out of the old world order that they lost in Egypt.
You know, do you think that the present day rulers in that sense see themselves as the people who actually have, you know, are descendant in that sense from the Egyptians? Do you think that they draw this connection themselves?
Oh, I believe they're bloodline connected. I believe that some of them are actually bloodline connected. And the vast majority, the ones we'd probably see on television or in the magazines and in the books, they tend to be ideologically descendants.
Okay, yeah.
You know, it's like the old question, you know, in the Atlantis book of, you know, what do you talk about when you mean the Nephilim? Well, some are bloodline connected, but, you know, that's going to be a very hard job to keep a pure bloodline for that length of time.
Sure, yeah.
But that's not the most important thing. What's important is that they have ideological converts. They have people who, and it's a, you know, the dragon bloodline. The dragon court. Now, 3,000 years isn't really that long. So, you know, there's are people who are descended from them by literally blood descendant. Descendancy. And then they have lieutenants. Then they have people who are, you know, ideologically conditioned to follow on with who they are. And then those people are definitely 100% behind the thrones of religion and government today. That's why the world is in the mess that it is. And these are disciples of light. They don't worship darkness. Can't people see that their symbolism is entirely to do with the light? So people need to wake up and understand what are the properties of light.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like going back to that contradiction we were talking about.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and the need for light. I mean, again, we've been addressing this, but let's do it again because it's important. You know, what there is an inherent need, I guess, for people in that sense to the, you know, we seek stuff that are, you know, of the light, and we when we go within and so forth, we look for the light. And the question is, what is it that we get in contact with when we do this?
Well, the ego, see, this connects then with the whole idea that the sun in the sky is the light of the outer world. And then your ego, and the word ego comes from the word egg. The word egg and ego come from the same word root.
Yeah, indeed.
The ego, the light within, it's like imagine an egg, right, that has that yellow part.
Sure.
Well, your ego is the light of your own consciousness within. So even ancient people understood this. They understood that your thinking, the organ of the brain or the thought, is like a light. It's like a luminescence within your own head. So you have a psychological light, and you have a physical light. And maybe Akhenaten or even the priests before him, because remember, solar worship goes way back before Akhenaten. His was just one little twig off the tree of solar worship. He didn't invent it. He didn't invent anything to do with monotheism. That's all his henchmen writing false history books to lead you astray. You know, Ammonism, that had gone back 3,000 years, Osirian, the Osirian, you know, tradition, and then if you take it back to the Irish connection, they had Isis, you know, I mean, one of the gods of light, and Taranis. So the Celts, you know, not the Celts, but the Irish, the Druids had, you know, these gods of light long before the Egyptians even heard of it. So this is a concept, and I think at during their time, they also realized that the action of thought, which gives luminescence to your thinking, there's a connection between the outer form of light and the inner form of light. And so from that moment on, you know, it got fused together, that there's a sort of a quest. And there's also a waning of that light. The light rises either in the zodiac or even during the year or even during a day. Even in the shortest period of time, which is just 24 hours, the sun rises and it's so strong. And then it burns brightly in midday, you know, it's very, very powerful. And then it wanes. So this also used to, I think, fascinate the ancient people, that there was a certain, there was almost three or four different kinds of light or power of the sun. You know, and ultimately they multiplied that to 12. That's why you have the 12 houses of the zodiac. You know, and then the Egyptians, some Egyptian schools even multiplied that further into 36 signs of the zodiac, which is what I go into in my online mystery school. We talk about the meaning of the 36. You know, 36 is a very important number in astrology. And the astrology I teach is very much based on this 36 houses of the zodiac. But, you know, basically, everyone knows the famous 12 signs of the zodiac, the 12 faces of the sun. And the 12 is based on the primal three, the three, you know, like all trinities, Rama, Vishnu, Shiva, you know, Bel, Taranis, and Isis, you know, you name it. The all over Egypt, they have the triads and the trinities.
Interesting.
So 3 and 8 and 10, these are all very important numbers to the to these people of the solar cult.
Three
but
times.
One thing is also is don't forget that they were brilliant observers of nature. And ultimately the Luciferian concept comes, I tie in for the Atlantis book, that the fall of Tiamat, the planet that I refer to as Tiamat, but that also has been referred to as Lucifer. And Marduk and Rahab and Phaeton, you know, there's all sorts of different names depending on the tradition. And I didn't call it Lucifer in the book because it just, it's too controversial, you know, it just sparked, the word Lucifer is so loaded. You know what I mean? I didn't want to have yet another, you know, interpretation of that. But the Romans always referred to Lucifer as Venus. So they were wrong. It wasn't Venus, but at least they took it up into the heavens. At least they associated what the name Lucifer originally, which is from Lucem Ferre, and it meant, they believed it meant Venus, meaning that it was one of the planets of the solar system. Now, I believe, of course, it wasn't Venus, it was actually Tiamat. That has also been called Phaeton and also has been called Lucifer. And the actual imagery that that is spoken of in the Bible and many other traditions about the falling serpent or the falling angel, you see? There's so many mythologies all over the world that talk about the one who falls from heaven. And this original being, I believe, was connected to a physical destruction of a planet. You know, remember we in the Atlantis book, I think we did a show where we talked about disaster. The very word means the destruction of a star. And catastrophe, meaning the destruction of a star. And also the fact that the word Sol, which is the name for our sun, literally means the alone one. Sol comes from the same term as solitary.
And solo.
And luna is a very close to, is exactly the word where we get our word luna, alone. So why would the ancients then be saying that their sun and their moon are called the alone ones? It almost presupposes the fact that once they were not alone. And then you check out a mythology and you find out, my God, there was a second sun up there. If you want to become specific about it, well, it wasn't actually a sun. It was a very large planet that was highly radiant. Well, that planet was destroyed. No, I'm the only scholar in the world that believes that the destruction was not, you know, natural. You'll have a lot of people who have written about this, from Zachariah Sitchin all the way back to Commons Beaumont, Emmanuel Velikovsky, Alan and Dallaire, the list goes on. But unfortunately, the difference with my work is that I don't believe that that was just destroyed by some comet, you know, or some natural action. In my work, I talk about that it was humanoid in destruction. But if we leave that aside for now and just realize that this planet was known as Lucifer, and the destruction of it and the shards or the remnants of this planet, you know, and this utter destruction, creating the asteroid belt and much of the destruction on other planets like the moon and also on Mars, all this havoc that is, can be seen there. Well, the people on our Earth saw this, you know, fiery planet destroyed and fall to Earth. It appeared to fall towards the Earth. And this is where you get the idea of the fallen one.
Oh,
the fallen,
indeed.
You know, somebody that was once a beautiful angel. Remember in the Bible it says, I think it's in Isaiah, when they describe Satan or Lucifer, they very much talk about, it's actually in the book of Ezekiel, that Lucifer is very beautiful.
Indeed.
Originally, before he fell, he's very beautiful.
Mm.
Well, this is a dead giveaway. You know, that this is talking about a celestial, beautiful orb that then got destroyed and fell towards the earth. And then, anecdotally, they also say that when the flames or the ball of the planet was destroyed and it was falling towards the earth, it fell into the sign of Scorpio. From the earth, where the sign of Scorpio was, particularly the 18th and 19th degree of the sign of Scorpio, which has always been considered malefic.
Okay.
That's where they saw this, you know, ball fall. And that's very interesting because if you pick up the tarot card number 13, you know, and look at it in the Rider-Waite deck, you will see a sun going down below the horizon in that card.
Ah.
And that card is the card of Scorpio.
Ah. So that is...
So again, just one more mystery that the tarot contains is the fall of Phaeton or the fall of Lucifer.
Ah. You know,
the sign of Scorpio.
Interesting. There was a report a while back from, I think it was BBC, and most, at least, accepted, whatever that means, but, you know, astrology, or astronomy, I should say, have come to the conclusion that most solar systems actually are binary, and it's, in a sense, you know, this connects with the entire theme that, you know, it's expressed in Star Wars and other movies, that there, you know, there are two suns on the horizon and so forth.
Well, I didn't know that, but that's incredible information.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
And, you know, it corroborates what the myths and I just go by the myths and legends, you know, and I believe what they basically say in there. You know, I've just studied them for so long that I have no problem accepting that stuff. And they would tend to agree with that. They say that, you know, there's two planetary orbs there at one time, and this was destroyed. And when it fell, you know, I think one of the, there's a tribe in the world that actually called that, Sata, S-A-T-A, can you believe it? One of the ancient legends of a very, very you know, early group.
Huh.
I think it was in Egypt, actually. They had a serpent god. That's what it was. And that's what it was called, S-A-T-A.
Sata
that fell like a flaming serpent. A Babylonian, they have Zu. Z-U was a god, a lightning god again. There's that lightning concept. You see, who fell as a certain kind of a fiery serpent.
Yeah.
You have in Greece, you have the myth of Icarus, you see?
Yeah, yeah.
Or you have Prometheus, you know, falling down. These are all corrupted versions, later versions of this, because as time goes by, myths get complicated, and they get several other myths get all tied up, you know?
Indeed, yeah.
But you have in the Bible Jesus saying, "Get behind me, Satan," meaning that, you know, now Jesus is the Son. Jesus is, you know, like Aton, or a solar god. And he doesn't want to be rivaled anymore by any other, you know, deity. This goes back to astrotheology and astrology.
Sure, sure.
Of the heliacal risings, you know. But you see, you turn to the Vedas. They mention the destruction of a celestial body. Ovid, Manilius, these are the Roman authors. Plato and Nonnus of the Greeks, they talked about it. So there's a lot there. And the most interesting thing that I think... needs to be understood is that why, again, remember one of those contradictions like we opened the show with? Why on earth is, if Lucifer is meant to be the god of evil, how come Jesus refers to himself as the morning star in the Bible?
Sure, exactly. There you have it.
You know, and it's not just in one place, but I think it's in Peter, or 2 Peter, where he literally is describing himself as the morning star.
Yeah.
And in Revelations 22, it's also, there's a connection made, and Jesus verbally says, when I am in the world, I am the light of the world.
Mm, sure.
You know, and I am the bright and morning star. And yet, you know, they're telling you, the same Christians will then tell you, but wait a minute, that's connected to Lucifer. Well, it's because Lucifer was a title of all kings. Lucifer was not a name. It referred to the bringers of light, the bringers of knowledge. Even Mary Magdalene in the Gnostic Gospels is called bringer of light, a Lucifer, literally called a Lucifer.
Hmm.
A bringer of the light.
Hmm.
Lucifer is connected to the son of the morning,
mm-hmm.
or the son of the dawning, as many of the texts say.
Mm-hmm.
Isaiah 14, right, describes, thou art fallen from heaven, O day star. I mean, there's even a Christian network called Day Star over in America.
Ah, okay. Interesting.
But thou art, how art thou fallen from heaven? So they say, how are you that you've fallen from heaven, O day star, son of the morning? This is exactly how Jesus describes himself.
Huh.
And that you shall be brought down, it says in Isaiah 14, and thou shalt be brought down to the nether world, to the utmost parts of the earth, or to the pit. So, in other words, they're talking about something falling into the pit. But from that moment on, you see, in occult ritual, the idea is that the sun gods, or the great Christs, or the great initiators, you see, are representatives of that knowledge, that light that has fallen from heaven.
Mm.
So it's nothing negative, you see, this is what people have to understand. But the most interesting thing is not only that you have references of Jesus identifying himself as a Lucifer, but the word Lucifer has the syllable luce, L-U-C-E, in Old French. That meant fish.
Mm. Oh. Huh.
See, L-U-C-E, Lucy,
mm-hmm.
in Latin, obviously, is where we get the word light.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
Like the girl's name, Lucy.
Sure.
But in Old French, Lusa meant fish. Now, wait a minute. Fish? That's the symbol that, you know, that the Christians use for Christ all
sure,
over the place.
Sure, absolutely, yeah. So another connection comes to light.
Apparently a contradiction until you realize what's going on here, that there's no difference between Lucifer and Jehovah and Jesus. You see, they're all connected because they're titles. And then somebody will jump in and say, well, wait a minute, that's brilliant, because Lucy, the word Lucy or locus, even the word in mathematics, loci or locus,
mm-hmm.
and that brings up there's another dimension to the fish. Lusa, or the fish, is the vesica Pisces of sacred geometry. You know, when you bring two circles together and you have that strange shape?
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely.
Right. So now we're into, wait a minute, that yes, the carpenter, the masons, that you've got the Jesus being the teacher, and he's symbolized by the fish, not because it's a physical fish or necessarily even the sign of Pisces or whatever.
Mm.
It's more to do with the fact that he's an initiator into sacred geometry, the great mysteries of architecture. And this whole symbolism of the fish is well known to geometrists because it represents this famous vesica Pisces. I mean, even in Christian art, you see, you know, Jesus in that shape.
Sure, sure.
In this, what they call the mandorla, or the shape of the fish, the vaginal symbol.
Mm, yeah.
It connects to the mother Mary and all the way back to Isis and everything else.
Hmm. And
this is, again, you know, secret knowledge. So Jesus being the keeper of secret knowledge.
Yeah.
Is the fish, or Lucifer.
Hmm.
So we're talking sun worship here. We're not necessarily talking Atenism. Atenism is a very specific kind of sun worship. It's not sun worship itself. So people have to realize that sun worship, solar cult, has been going on for thousands of years. Atenism was a particularly skewed version. And the kind of Luciferianism that might be critiqued today by Christians and others is Atenism. And it's a skewed form of solar worship. It's really, to me, it's the dark side of the sun.
Mm.
It's something of these other properties of light that people need to start getting with it and to find out that there's other properties that light has.
Hmm.
Light can conceal as well as reveal.
Yeah, indeed, yeah.
Light can blind and burn, you know, and that's what the Illuminati are calling themselves, the man of light, or the princes of knowledge, or the Luciferians, for a reason, because they know how to manipulate and use light as a weapon.
Hmm.
And most people have not come to understand yet how light has been used as a weapon in our society, and how advertisements and television and just light itself in our culture, in the ambiance, in the social ambiance, how light is used to confuse and to bedazzle and to drug, you see, and to kill even.
Absolutely, and it is the blinding light in that sense.
The blinding light, exactly.
Also, I guess that this is kind of connected with the idea of the, as we spoke about earlier, that this is the flame within, or the intellect, or the spark, or the intelligence that is, in a sense, connected with the, you know, archetype, I guess, of Lucifer in that sense.
That's right. And, you know, that goes back to the concept that the inner Lucifer is your own intelligence, your own light. And we can become slaves of that knowledge, just like the Masons become slaves of the secret knowledge of promise of hierarchy. Of course, everybody wants status within that hierarchy, so they're itching to get to become, you know, captains. And
sure.
So that becomes a very big lure, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Well, same. What's going on inside the average brain of most people? Tremendous desire for more knowledge.
Yeah.
I want to sit at the right hand of God. I want to have all the knowledge in the world. You know, I'm gonna be the biggest brain. I'm gonna be a Mensa.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I'm gonna have all secret knowledge, enlightenment.
Yeah.
But there's no end to it. You know. So it's a lure externally, and it's a lure inwardly. People are very avaricious, and they're hypnotized, absolutely addicted to the phenomena of light. You know, in the book, there's going to be a chapter on Luciferianism and specifically dealing with this, about the eroticism, if you want to call it that, of light, and the whole idea that light is being used as a lure, and knowledge, people's pursuit of knowledge, it can become a most, you know, egregious thing. That they're gaining knowledge, but that knowledge is not actually spiritualizing anyone. The quest for knowledge, the motive of why you want to look for knowledge, is the wrong thing. The knowledge is not wrong, but the motive of why somebody might want that knowledge might be just to, you know, fulfill their senses, or to give them, you know, greater material reward or standing, or whatever, or, you know, to, so that they can be big, you know, big noise in the world.
And a sense of control also, in a sense, you know, I can feel this myself. I want to, you know what's going on, but obviously, as you say, definitely can, in that sense, become an obsession, and you tend to, you know, lean towards more, you know, trusting on your intellect than your, you know, intuition or feeling, maybe.
Exactly. The one-sidedness.
Yeah.
And then once people have become addicted to the light, addicted to that kind of quest for knowledge, can they ever put it aside? You know, are they going to be able to, you know, look at the what we might call the lunar side of ourselves? You know, the feminine side, the feminine qualities.
Sure.
You know, this Kabbalistic concept of the, you know, I would say that the Luciferian principle has always been Kabbalistically connected to the fifth zone, which is known in Hebrew as Gebura.
Okay.
And Gebura means to divide or to break, because that's the breaking point. If you have 10 circles, then the fifth one is obviously halfway.
Okay.
So the circles, or the spheres, 1 to 5, is where spirit is quite strong, but from 5 to 10 is where matter starts taking over. I'm not saying I believe this, is just I'm telling Kabbalistically.
Yeah, sure, I understand.
Just Kabbalistic, pure Kabbalistic anecdotal stuff.
Sure.
That they say that it's at the fifth sephira, at the fifth sphere, that there becomes a problem, because spirit, for the first time now, has to negotiate matter. So from the Gebura down to Malkuth, meaning from the fifth sphere down to the tenth sphere, then you have matter dragging the soul, you know, down.
Sure.
Whereas from Kether to Gebura, or from zone one to zone five, spirit still is dominant. And therefore, they say that the fifth zone is given over to more of the, you know, demonic principle, or let's say that the Luciferian principle is stronger there. You know, and of course, you know, different people can argue on this, you know, till ad infinitum, like, but
yeah, sure, yeah.
That's why they say that number five is always, you know, the pentagram is considered devil worship and all that, you know.
Okay, I see. Very interesting. You know, I think it's appropriate to kind of round things off here, but I do want to kind of, I guess, end on this note, or throw this out to you and see if you want to pick up on it. In his novel 2010, Arthur C. Clarke, of course, mentioning the, you know, the, I guess that they ignite the planet Jupiter, and after it is ignited into a second sun, it is referred to, I think, as Lucifer. Have you, that's quite an interesting, you know, concept. Have you heard about that before?
Yes, I did. And when was that meant to have happened?
I think 2010 then, I guess, but I'm not sure.
2010, well, that's kind of frightening, because, you know, we know that a lot of stuff is going to be happening in the next couple of years.
Yeah.
That's the last thing we need. But I did hear about it, because I actually heard that from Anthony J. Hilder, you know, of Radio Free World, and he had a big thesis on that.
Sure, and this actually connects with that they actually did crash a sonde, or a what do you call it? can't find the word, one of NASA's, you know, the satellite, basically, that actually contained plutonium, and they just theorized that this actually might spark a, you know, an ignition of the entire planet, considering the potential chain reaction that takes place consequently to this. So I don't know what's going on there, but I've heard that they're going to crash some more into that, you know, around that time frame. I'm not sure if what happened with the last one that crashed into it, but it seems like Jupiter is a place where they kind of, it's like a dump, I guess, where they, you know, after things have taken their turn, so to speak, a satellite or whatever, they dump it into that planet because of the, you know, gravitational pull and all of that. So
you never know what they're up to. I mean, you know, from ritualistic purposes, look at this whole thing with the denial of the planet Pluto even existing.
Sure.
You know, or no, it's a speck of dust. No, it's a planet. No, wait a minute, it's this, it's that. You know, I mean, all this back and forth. They make up one thing 1 minute, and then they change the rituals. Just like I've been saying, in ancient times, they change the mythologies. Every age, every processional age, there's reasons why, you know, there's different symbolism from the age of Taurus into Aries. There's, you know, we're in Pisces now, so the symbolism has been very largely of the fish.
Indeed, yeah.
And so many other symbols. Then when we go into Aquarius, it's going to be needed to be changed again. But within those particular ages, there's also need to be constantly, you know, changing the symbolism again, given all sorts of other, you know, reasons that they need to do this. We only have to watch the media, you know, to see how they manipulate different people, different actors and actresses, different memes. It's very subtle. Different colors, you know, different symbolic tropes are always being used. You know, there'll be a whole spate of Egyptian programs on at a particular time, you know, and then suddenly they'll be focusing on the Irish or the Maya or the UFOs, you know. These things are done often in patterns. You know, at specific times as to why they would want to do that. And Jupiter, of course, is a very powerful symbolism. It's one of the oldest symbols going back.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, is connected to the god Jupiter and all the way back to Ptah and to it originally comes from Dispater, which is All Father. It's a very ancient Celtic deity.
Oh, yeah. Iupiter, yeah, Piter.
That's right. Yeah. And Peter, you know, going back to Ptah and also to Petra. You know, there's so much symbolism there with all of this. So each thing that looks like it's being played out in the physical domain has a whole symbolic, you know, canon behind it that people are, it's much more important, I think, for people to understand what that's about. Because they're showing you all these logos and they're showing all these symbols and people, you know, they just take it as natural. They're not realizing, you know, that the stuff that's being thrown in your face also has a very important symbolic meaning.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you see, it's not so much about planets outside, it's about archetypes within your collective unconscious.
Exactly, and that's a very interesting point. I think that is why this, I guess, is so important for them, because it is the in the world, or even the in the imagination of the, you know, the our collective, you know, unconscious, as you say, that these things actually are, you know, we feed this energy into it all the time, and we, you know, we are focused on it on one level or another, and this is actually what, you know, creates collectively our, you know, our archetypes, I guess, and our mythologies, right?
That's right. And see, like I said, there's small cycles and big cycles. 2010, 2012, we're dealing with the black sun. So, you know, you have Atenism, you've got the worship of the sun up there. Yeah, this one sun, and hey, there may have even been a second sun, Tiamat, Phaeton, Lucifer, whatever you want to call it.
Sure.
And if these people worshipped that as a god, and then that god fell to earth, they're going to say that Lucifer is on earth.
Ah, of course.
And if they ever picked up even pieces of it, you know, just like a fallen comet, those will become sacred relics.
How about the Kaaba stone, the you know, the in the
that's
Saudi
right.
Arabia?
No, that's not a piece of the of Phaeton.
Exactly.
Or, you know, Tiamat.
Sure.
And then in 2012 we go even higher up the ladder than that. The great galactic cycle is going around a orb, going around a central sun, known as the central sun to scientists, or galactic center to astronomers. But galactic center was always known as the black sun to occultists.
Sure. Yeah.
So there's many kinds of light. There's many kinds of, you know, sun. And a lot of times these secret society guys are using symbols not just of the physical sun, which is kind of obvious when you see the sun as the sun as the sun. You can tell, okay, Aton there looks like the sun disk. But there's also symbolism of the black sun, like the Smithsonian logo and the swastika.
Indeed, yeah, yeah.
You know, and there's even on Bracken House in London, you have the symbol of the black sun. And people will see this even on certain churches where it's not quite, you know, or even Kodak. you know, using like an eclipse.
Exactly, that, and I mean that's a highly, you know, used to be and still are in a sense, you know, very, I guess, you know, spiritual, you know, thing to actually witness, you know, a what looks like in that sense then a black sun or eclipse. I have this you know as a logo type thing on my website, and I mean it's fascinating to see, and that I guess in a sense is when the you know it actually looks like an eye coming alive when it moves, you know, across the over the sun basically.
Right, and there's another reason why they may have, you know, had the eye as a very, very ancient symbol in solar worship.
Mm.
You know, but and in fact, if you really get into the symbolism of the black sun, according to physicists, they claim that the energy, the divine energy that is, you know, that coming from the central sun, the vortex that is in, actually it's physically in Sagittarius, the center of the galaxy, you know, is where the Milky Way runs, and the Milky Way runs between Gemini and Sagittarius.
Hmm.
And the central sun is at Sagittarius. That's why Sagittarius shows an archer. Because the arrow of the archer, the centaur of Sagittarius, is actually pointing towards the target of central sun.
That's yeah, exactly.
They have this.
Yeah.
It's sort of as a marker, you know, say, hey, there's the central sun.
Fascinating.
And of course, the river, the Milky Way, was the river that the Pharaoh's boat, you know, is meant to have traversed.
Yeah, indeed.
Traversed. So he's literally on his boat, the boat of Ra, the boat of Horus, sailing towards the central sun.
Sure.
But it's even though it's called a black sun by many occultists, they claim that the energy that comes out of galactic center is blue.
Hmm.
And they say that that is the place of the blue light.
Okay. Hmm.
And it's even been called the room of the blue light, the house of the blue light.
Hmm.
And of course, what are the degrees of Freemasonry called in the beginning?
Blue Lodge.
Yeah, the Blue Lodge or the Blue Degrees.
The Blue Degrees, yeah. Hmm.
And you will see so many logos, especially logos for technical companies, that show you emanating blue lights. In America, you've got AT&T.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
You know, and they use what looks like an orb, like a sun, but it's blue.
Hmm.
and don't you have the colors of Israel are blue, the colors of the police?
Sure, exactly, yeah.
Right, they're not wearing black, they're wearing blue often all over the world. How many Swedish police, if I'm not mistaken?
Indeed, they are actually changing some of that to these illuminated ones now. They have the green, you know, more British type thing. And it feels like they're actually changing this across Europe, but I'm not sure about that. But it's interesting nonetheless, you know. So they become the illumined ones, and then the army police have these black uniforms, basically.
Oh, my God. But didn't they once have blue shirts?
Yeah, indeed. I mean, the police have basically always been blue up here, and some actually are still, I think. So yes, indeed.
That's right. And
yeah.
Interpol, you know, so this color blue, which is again the United Nations blue, as it's called.
Mm, exactly. Yeah.
What's all this blue, you know, stuff? This is all connected to. It seems like a contradiction to black sun.
Mm-hmm.
But those who really know, again, here we're dealing with, you know, initiates and non-initiates.
Mm.
Those who are really into the symbolism of the black sun, which includes a lot of these secret societies, understand that the color blue is actually all, you know, is connected to this. And that's why you have these blue lodges.
Mm.
It's a tremendous symbolism coming out of that. And one of the symbols of the swastika, even though the swastika was a symbol of agony, fire, you know, and there's, again, that's for outer initiates. Inner initiates knew that that's why Hitler, you know, spoke of the swastika as the black sun, that they were knights of the black sun.
Huh.
And I go into this in the Atlantis DVD, that this swastika is also a radiating, you know, it's radiating energy from the central sun. Now, what is happening, 2012?
Mm.
The physical sun, our sun of our solar system, the sun itself, Sol, is conjuncting with the galactic center.
Yes, yeah.
So, you know, symbolism, maybe just symbolism to a lot of people, but we got to realize this is also connected to physical, astrological phenomena that they don't want you to know anything about because this signals great changes in your life that they prefer you don't make. Because the last thing that the controllers of the world want is a free, sane, curious, independent, you know, free-thinking individual who's a most dangerous animal to them.
Yeah.
Especially to start standing on their toes and start to learn some of the stuff that they're into.
Indeed.
You know, to sort of say, hey, I don't need your lodges and your stupid degree ceremonies.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to pick up a book and read it. I'm going to listen to some bands or some music that's going to turn me on to a lot of this stuff. I'm going to find out myself. I'm going to use the internet. You know, we don't need any of this hierarchy and this promise of sacred knowledge where my real identity and my real humanness is left in the gutter while I'm, you know, making inroads up your, you know, Luciferian hierarchy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, this is, you know, maybe once upon a time it was okay to be doing things like that, but it became corrupt. It's every hierarchy is corrupt. The universe is not a hierarchy, it's a holarchy, as any scientist knows. You know, it's based on a fractal system, it's based on a holographic system, it's based on a holarchy, and unless humanity gets back to this holarchy, which is not going to happen until these ego-based, you know, drives are basically deconstructed. Man seeking after knowledge, seeking to be better, seeking to be greater, you know, in a sort of an avaricious way. You can be superior, but be superior through knowledge that is your own effort that is put into it, your own mastery, your own artisanship. Nobody's going to question that. Nobody's going to question that Rembrandt wasn't a genius, you know. Yeah, he was, but he did it his own way. He didn't join some club, you know. It's a glorified club. As you say, that's sterile. It's almost a joke. It's like a facade.
Exactly. It feels just, you know, stale and silly, basically. I mean, it's incredible, you know. And I just wanted to relay this before I forget, the Hopi legend of the blue kachina. That is very interesting in regards to the blue light that you were speaking about, and actually that might connect with the ending of the, you know, fifth age or fourth age, whatever that actually is. But again, that might be a relay or a connection, that the blue kachina actually might be our own sun, which actually are radiating the galactic central sun, the light from that. I don't know.
It does. That's exactly. I'm glad you brought that up, because it does. And, you know, look how important lapis was to the ancient Egyptians, you know, lapis lazuli, and certain stones. The American Indians uses lapis a lot, you know, the blue stone. So we're dealing with something very powerful here because of this energy.
Indeed.
And we all know that, you know, the on the spectrum, ultraviolet.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, when you move towards the blues and the violets, you're dealing with what they call higher frequency spiritual healing energy, whereas as opposed to if you move towards the infrared, you know,
the lower frequencies,
to work with more pathogenic forces.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah, it's a tremendous study, that.
Absolutely, it's fascinating. Michael, I think that this is an excellent place to kind of round things up, I guess. You know, as always, the discussion continues, and again, it's always fascinating to have you on, and we appreciate it very much. As always, I want to leave the last few minutes to you with your, you know, opportunity to mention your DVDs, your works, your books, and, of course, your website.
Well, the concept of Lucifer is dealt with in the new book. So, and people can see excerpts if they go to taroscopes.com and then go to the astrotheology pages. There's on page one, you'll see a link saying the Luciferians, Princes of Light. So it's right there on page one, astrotheology, which can be found on taroscopes.com, and they can get a much deeper understanding of what we're talking about today. I think that's the only place I really deal with that. I mean, obviously, I deal with the Tiamat thing at great length in Atlantis DVD.
In your DVDs, absolutely. And people can find your DVDs by going to originsandoracles.com, and also, of course, your website, michaeltesarian.com, that has links to all your other websites and, you know, your blog and so forth. So that's what people need to check out. With that, let's say thanks for this time, Michael, and we will speak again soon.
Absolutely, Anna. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, if you think